We've spoken previously about security and software supply chains, and we're back at it on this episode. We're diving in again with Charlie Coggins. Charlie works at a software supply chain company and is on the episode to give us an insider's look and a defender's perspective on how to keep our Python apps and infrastructure safe. This is Talk Python to Me, episode 457, recorded January 24th, 2024. Welcome to Talk Python to Me, a weekly podcast on Python. This is your host, Michael Kennedy. Follow me on Mastodon, where I'm at mkennedy, and follow the podcast using at talkpython, both on bostodon.org. Keep up with the show and listen to over 7 years of past episodes at talkpython.fm. We've started streaming most of our episodes live on YouTube. Subscribe to our YouTube channel over at talkpython.fm/YouTube to get notified about upcoming shows and be part of that episode. This episode is brought to you by Sentry. Don't let those errors go unnoticed. Use Sentry like we do here at TalkPython. Sign up at talkpython.fm/Sentry. And it's brought to you by Mailtrap, an email delivery platform that developers love. Use their email sandbox to inspect and debug emails in staging, dev, and QA environments before sending them to recipients in production. Try Mailtrap for free at talkpython.fm/Mailtrap. Hey, Charlie, welcome to Talk Python to Me.
Hi, Michael.
Great to have you here. We have corresponded back and forth about security things. And now, are you here to scare us? Is that what's going to happen?
It's going to seem that way. There are threats everywhere, especially when you start looking. And that's the problem. You look, you'll find them. If you're not looking, you might get affected without even knowing it.
Yeah, but that's true. But we're also going to come with some tools and techniques and tips on how to avoid security problems with your Python code.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's an especially, concerning, that certainly catches my attention, that if you mess with somebody's software, like the software builders, the developers, it gets shipped to however many users are on the other side of that equation, right? It's not like I just took over some teenager's gaming PC and now what can I do? It's like I took over, you know, name your big web app, and now we're going to start shipping some stuff around.
Yes.
All right. That's where the sort of multiplicative aspect of this gets more concerning than just standard personal computer safety, right?
Oh, absolutely. A single developer can have very broad impact. With, maybe they publish one package, but that one package could be included in hundreds, thousands of other packages as a dependency, and then everyone using those packages could be affected, whether the code is good and works as intended or poorly written and has bugs and vulnerabilities,
yeah,
or maybe it's malicious.
This is not to say there's any chance of there being a problem with Pydantic, but just to make your point, if you go to like Pydantic or Request or something like that, a lot of these have used by projects, right? And this Pydantic is used by 315,000 people, software projects that themselves have users, right? And so that's the kind of stuff that I'm thinking about when I said that multiplicative effect, right? It's a big multiplier, not just a couple.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Now, before we dive into our main topic, of course, tell people a bit about yourself.
Hi. Well, my name is Charles Coggins. I usually go by Charlie. And I'm a Python developer. I'm a software developer, but not through the traditional sense. I don't have a computer science degree. I didn't come to this, straight out of school. Mm-hmm. I got my first taste of programming long enough ago, back in the 80s, in 1987. My dad got a computer for us, and I was messing around on there with some games. Always with games, right? The time it was BASIC. It was this bowling game that my brother and I would play, and I saw that I could look at the code, I could look at the source, and I went in there and modified it a bit to make it so that I would always win whenever I played him.
How long did it take him to catch on?
Oh, he figured out pretty quickly, and he was in there too, changing ball speed and how often he could get a gutter or make him get a gutter. I took a class or two in high school and college, but I was an electrical engineering major, and then went to work for the government doing something that wasn't even really that. So I spent 10 years working for the government before they stood up the U.S. Cyber Command and decided or figured out that they needed to hire 6,000 new developers to fill the positions. And there weren't that many available in the industry, let alone those who could, you know, pass the clearances and work in that environment. So they looked to people already working in the government. Mm-hmm. And I raised my hand. I said, yes, I want to cross train. I'll be a developer. And so they trained
Excellent.
Me.
What did they teach you for language in that program?
We started with C, C++, and then there was some Python. So I went through a couple of boot camps and a lot of self-learning, self-teaching. Python's the one that really clicked for me. It just made sense in my head.
Yeah, of course. If you're learning to do cybersecurity stuff, you know, a lot of times I'd be happy to tell people like, you don't really need to learn C or Rust or Java. Just if you just know Python, you're probably 90% of the time golden. But if you're trying to do cybersecurity, a lot of times it's about like the machine level stuff, right? Understanding things like C and pointers and buffer overflows and all of that kind of stuff is where you actually kind of need to be, right?
And they taught us all that as well. In fact, we learned assembly language as well, and that one really didn't fit in my brain. So
you're not like, I'd want to become an assembly language programmer.
I mean, that's a whole different breed.
Yeah, it sure is. And you know, it used to be, I remember when I first got into programming, I was doing some C++, and inline assembly was something people would do a lot to optimize. A lot like people might do Cython or Numba or something like that to make Python fast. Like, we'll find this little part and we'll rewrite it in this way and be like, we're just going to do inline assembly. I'm like, that just doesn't seem like worthwhile. I don't need that much performance. We're going to not do that.
Yeah.
Fun. So now you're working at Phylum. Is it Python focused or just software security?
It's not Python focused. In fact, the company primarily develops with Rust, as you were mentioning. Okay. We've got some excellent Rust developers at our company, and I think that's what's attracted a lot of them is that is the primary language we use. But we also have some elements in Python. And when I came on board, I got assigned to work on our integrations, GitHub integrations, GitLab, pre-commit hooks, things like that. And so I was able to kind of architect it the way I thought best. And because I love Python, I made it all in Python and, you know, exposed it through. Excellent. Docker containers.
are you doing direct integration with Rust like PyO3 or are you, is it more
no the
commands out
the Rust elements that our company works on, like, so our API, the command line interface, a lot of the back end, it's just written straight Rust, and then the Python is just plain Python. There's no interface between the two, really.
Okay, consuming APIs and Docker containers and stuff like that.
Right. Although I am interested in the PyO3, and I think I would, you know, there's room to bridge the two languages at our company.
Well, I mean, for sure, people are adopting Rust for the performance foundations of Python. You know, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. That's I've been at the company almost 2 years now. I keep saying it's what I'm going to learn next is Rust, and I felt like I would just kind of absorb it by going through code reviews and the people on my team. It hasn't happened yet, you know. I can kind of understand what's going on by reading it, but I need to jump in.
Okay, got it. Those are the same. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting. Okay, well, we're not here to talk about Rust, although I do think it's becoming one of those things that is sort of. I don't know if you need to be a little one level deeper in the Python space. That used to be C, and now I think it's pretty solidly moving to be Rust, right? There's a lot of popular things. Pydantic, for example, I pulled up earlier, where that's the foundation, but that also seems to be where the momentum is.
Yeah, the oxidation of Python libraries is a real thing. I mean, you know, look at Ruff, right?
Ruff. I just heard about Granium, I think it was, which is a new similar to G-Unicorn and MicroWhiskey, is a Rust-based async server. You know, it goes on and on.
This portion of Talk Python to Me is brought to you by OpenTelemetry Support at Sentry. In the previous two episodes, you heard how we use Sentry's error monitoring at Talk Python and how distributed tracing connects errors, performance, and slowdowns, and more across services and tiers. But you may be thinking, our company uses OpenTelemetry, so it doesn't make sense for us to switch to Sentry. After all, OpenTelemetry is a standard, and you've already adopted it, right? Well, did you know, with just a couple of lines of code, you can connect OpenTelemetry's monitoring and reporting to Sentry's backend? OpenTelemetry does not come with a backend to store your data, analytics on top of that data, a UI, or error monitoring. And that's exactly what you get when you integrate Sentry with your OpenTelemetry setup. Don't fly blind. Fix and monitor code faster with Sentry. Integrate your OpenTelemetry systems with Sentry and see what you've been missing. Create your Sentry account at talkpython.fm/sentry-telemetry. And when you sign up, use the code TALKPYTHON, all caps, no spaces. It's good for 2 free months of Sentry's business plan, which will give you 20 times as many monthly events as well as other features. My thanks to Sentry for supporting TalkPython to me. All right, well, let's talk about software security, though. You know, like, we touched on it a little bit with the multiplicative aspect, like why software developers should care. But maybe let's start with some ways in which viruses might get on your computer from a software perspective. Not from like, oh, you know, I found this cool app on BitTorrent, and normally it's paid, but this one's free. It's like, maybe don't install that. But you know, not that kind of advice, right? But you know, specifically for software developers.
Right. So for software developers, I think the primary vector, you know, for malicious code running in your environment, or really any developer environment along the way, it doesn't just have to be your system. It could be your CI/CD servers, you know, your runners. It's going to be software dependencies, third-party code, right? Mm-hmm. Code from strangers on the internet, right? That's really what it boils down to. Is, you know, it's
they're just here to help out. They're just giving you the code to help out. They have no bad intentions.
Right.
Except for that one over there. Don't take their code.
Yeah, and it's hard to tell, you know, what's good, what's bad. And I think we all rely on third-party code. I mean, it's a rare company, rare project that writes everything from scratch on their own without any dependencies. So that's a vector for sure, is allowing code from strangers on the internet to run. I think like the name of the game, right, for attackers and threat actors is arbitrary code execution. Like that's the key phrase, arbitrary code execution. If I can get arbitrary code execution with this vulnerability, then I've won.
Get a CVE score of 9 or above. It's right there. And then
exactly. And that's for vulnerabilities. That's just, you know, poorly written code or code with bugs. But forget about vulnerabilities. I mean, if you're an attacker, you're a threat actor, you've already got the perfect means to run arbitrary code, to gain arbitrary code execution on a developer's system. And that's with third-party dependencies. Open source software is the perfect target for writing malware or slipping malware into packages. And
now when people hear this, we've talked about it enough. It actually came as quite a surprise a few years ago. People theoretically knew that it could happen, but that it was happening is that packages on package stores like PyPI and NPM and so on got published vulnerabilities that people could then install and make part of theirs. But there's a whole software supply chain, right? Maybe talk us through some of the different elements that make that up. Only one of which is these libraries, right?
That's right. So the software supply chain is using third-party code securely, as well as securing the end-to-end development process. So that process is, you know, very broadly broken into 3 phases. You've got the source phase, that's, you know, source control management systems, and then actually coding, developers coding on their systems, you know, committing to repositories.
Yeah, and having, you know, you mentioned the dependencies like pip install this or that.
Yep.
There's also, for many of the really popular IDEs and editors, there's a whole massive array of varying levels of trusted plugins or extensions, right, as well.
That's right. Yeah. Like Visual Studio Code, that's what I use for my IDE. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got a extensive extension ecosystem. Just about anything you want to do. You know, I get a little pop-up when I open a new project and it says, oh, I recognize you're using a YAML file. Do you want to download this extension that will lint YAML files, right? Like,
yeah, I got one for CVEs. For that. It was like Rainbow CSV syntax highlighter or something. I'm like, you know what? That's not really made by a trusted company. It's probably fine. Probably fine. But I don't need my CSV files highlighted so much so that I'm willing to just like run arbitrary code from a stranger on the internet.
That's right.
Right.
Yep.
And, you know, I use both PyCharm and VS Code, and they both, especially PyCharm, has sort of a warning that says, this is untrusted. It's a third party thing. Are you sure you want it? Like,
just saying, you know,
that's a pretty light warning.
Yeah.
And also, they're not the same, right? Is it installed by a million people used every day, or is it, are you the fourth person to use it and it hasn't had the experience of people going, why is it called open in a network socket? What's it doing? You know, something like that.
Yeah. That's another entry point you got to be careful about. And
all right, well, I cut you off. We're only in like square one of maybe nine.
Yeah, square one, source code, and then there's the build phase. That's where you take the code, you take the commits that have gone into source control, and you build something with it, right? This usually happens in, you know, your CI/CD systems like GitHubs and GitLabs of the world, and it's at that point where you know, your third-party dependencies get included and wrapped up into your artifacts, right? Which brings us to the third stage of the software supply chain, which is the package and deploy phase. That's where you're creating your artifacts and making them available to the world to use.
Could be anything. Could be a wheel for a library that other parts of your company use to build software.
Yep,
some app you ship. It could actually be a website, an API. Who knows, right?
Yeah, Docker container. Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
And then by the time you get to that, you know, the end of the supply chain, and you know, the products or the packaged product that people are going to see and use and work with, you know, you've baked in so many elements at that point. You know, from your third-party dependencies to you know, any other external resources that are getting called. So there's lots of points along the way that it's possible to
One of the things that can be sneaky is, you know, it doesn't happen that often in Python, but if you're shipping like a Windows or a Mac app, there's a digital signature proof of, we're going to sign this with our trusted certificate. So it doesn't even give you any warnings. Like, look, this is, it's signed by the company. It is trusted. Here you go. Take it. Right. And if somewhere upstream from that, there's an issue like with packages or other things, well, that issue is now, that problem is signed and verified as well.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so you mentioned code signing, the research team at our company. I mean, they're amazing, group there. They're always finding new and novel attacks. And one they found just this past week involved something kind of cool, where the attacker had bundled up a valid Microsoft binary. It had been signed by Microsoft, but they bundled it with a DLL that was malicious. It was named something to be expected, right? So when you run the executable on the binary, you know, you could see that there's this Microsoft signed application, looking for permissions, looking to continue, and you think, oh yeah, great, signed by Microsoft, no problem. But then it uses this technique called like DLL search order hijacking.
That
technique, right? So if you have a DLL that's being called by the application more locally than Not it's that's what's gonna so be called.
It's so looking it's for the something same directory. Yeah,
it'll look in like the, looking for the name of the DLL in this in the same directory first. Basically, is what's happening.
Right, and right.
They had shipped their bad DLL with
that's good nuts.
Binary.
So you pick something in System 32 that's got like a real common name like VC runtime whatever .dll or you know some of the standard ones, but then you completely reprogram it.
Yeah.
And stick it in there with that app. Or maybe not completely because you need the app to not crash, but you give it some extra boost when when it does something, right?
Yeah. Yeah. In this case, they had just copied all the files needed for execution into a new directory, including the known good binary, the known bad DLL, and then you know, it had everything it needed in that directory to run, and it looked like it was legitimate.
Right. Because a lot of the OS dependent, a lot of these OS checks are on the executable. Mm-hmm. Not the system libraries that they use, right?
Right, right.
Right. You'll see like this executable is downloaded from the internet. Are you sure you want to run it? Like that doesn't say this executable, which you trust, is maybe possibly using a library that you downloaded. Like it doesn't say that, right? Yeah, because we could never get work done if there was that level of checking all over the place. Right? This is an updated somewhere. This portion of Talk Python to Me is brought to you by Mailtrap. We're going to keep this super short, so please pay attention or you'll miss it. Mailtrap is an email delivery platform that developers love, an email sending solution with industry-best analytics, SMTP, and email APIs and SDKs for major programming languages with 24/7 human support. What makes them unique is their email sandbox. Use email sandbox to inspect and debug emails in staging, dev, and QA environments before sending them to recipients in production. Try Mailtrap for free at talkpython.fm/mailtrap. That's kind of the space that we're talking about, right? We've got editors, we've got libraries that you use, CI/CD pipelines, containers are super interesting as well, and all the tools to go with those. So let's talk through some of the posts that you've written and also just selected about some of these things, and maybe starting to the front of that list there with lock files.
Yeah. Okay. So, I wrote a blog post. I guess it's looking at the date on your screen. It looks like it was over a year ago now.
And probably seems like yesterday, but no.
Yeah, that's right.
2022 it was.
So I'm sure the landscape has changed since then a bit, and maybe there's some new players out there. But I think one thing you can do as a developer, a big one I would recommend is use lock files. For your dependencies, right? And what's a lock file? Well, it's the fully resolved set of dependencies that are used by your application, your package. If nothing else, like you should know what's going into your code, right? Like what?
Right.
Well, not
one
just
of the
your
ways
direct
this helps. Yeah, exactly. That's a bit of a challenge, right? And I think I'll admit when I first got into Python, I didn't do this that well. And you know, to me, it felt like probably the biggest issue I might run into is instability in my app, right? Like for example, if I don't pin a dependency, some new thing comes out, I reinstall it on a new computer, maybe it gets an upgraded version, and there's some library that doesn't work, right? I mean, there's been certainly popular libraries that just said we're having a major version change and we're fixing the mistakes we made 10 years ago. And these three functions are changing or whatever, right? That would break it. But it could also be there's now a malicious version of library X, and that's version 2. But if you pinned it on version 1, even though it's bad, you're still not getting the bad one, at least for a while, right?
Absolutely. Yes. So I think I got to look it up. I always forget. PEP 665.
Okay.
PEP 665. It's a rejected PEP, unfortunately, but it was written by Brett Cannon, some others. I know you've had Brett on the show a number of times. I love the stuff he does. You know, he really understands all of this. And it's kind of a shame this was rejected, but this PEP tried to create a standard lock file format for Python. If you look into the PEP a little bit, there's some motivation about like why you'd want to do this, and four big reasons. And the third one is one I really key on, which is that lock files allow for reproducibility, and reproducibility is just more secure. Because when, you know, I'm quoting here from the PEP, says when you control exactly what files are installed, you can make sure no malicious actor is attempting to slip nefarious code into your application, i.e. Yeah. some supply chain attacks. By using a lock file, which always leads to reproducible installs, we can avoid certain risks entirely. And I mean, that's the name of the game. That's like, that's, that's what our company yeah. focuses on, which is avoiding those risks by ensuring yeah. you know which dependencies you're using and you're knowing that those dependencies are benign or good, you know, doing no harm.
Even if there is something that happens, usually it's going to happen to a popular library because you're using it, hence probably other people are using it other than typo squatting, which we can talk about. But
yeah,
you know, if you pin your dependencies, chances are these things only stick around for a little while. It's not like, oh, they discovered it had been there for 8 months. It's like, oh my gosh, we heard about it. A few people got it and then we got rid of it, right?
Yes.
The folks
yes.
at PyPA are pretty excellent. So it's to some degree a timing issue as well.
Yes. Yeah. Vulnerabilities are different, right? Where that's what a lot of people focus on. A lot of the tooling exists to you know, discover vulnerabilities in your dependencies, which is right. good to know about those, but those exist for a long time, right? You have CVEs for known vulnerabilities and they end up in these databases and they're there for years. And if you're using old dependencies or maybe transitive dependencies or using old ones and you're stuck on it, then you're going to be exposed to those vulnerabilities. But what's different
examples,
about
the, sorry, examples of those yeah. include the WebP library not too long ago, right?
Uh-huh,
that
uh-huh.
was baked into Python, and then also OpenSSL, right? So people discovered issues in those. Those are baked into different aspects of Python or some of the libraries. And it's like, well, all of a sudden there's this fire drill.
Yes.
Which is different than somebody going, I'm going to sneak a thing into the library
right.
system.
And then it is a timing matter. So malicious dependencies, that's a whole other story. Because if a malicious package is discovered, there's not a CVE created for it. The package is just taken off of the registry. You know, you mm-hmm. report it to the good people at PyPI and you know, they'll review the submission and take it down. I've done a few of those myself. And yeah. They're really fast, but there's still a window of time where that malicious package, that malicious dependency is up and available. And that's, you know,
yeah, so I do think pinning your dependency helps. Yeah, exactly. I do think having a pin dependency there is worthwhile. Cause if you make a commit, your CI runs, et cetera, right? Like the chances that you just bump the version to this malicious thing is pretty low.
Yeah, exactly. So having version ranges is not enough. You know, you need to have explicit versions, you know.
All right, let's talk more about these lock files then, right?
Yes.
So there's actually a bunch of choices these days. And, you know, Brett's PEP tried to make it less of a choice. Say, well, it doesn't matter if you use Hatch or PIP or Poetry or whatever, the outcome is the same. And for reasons that I haven't learned enough about, I don't know why that didn't work, but... Let's talk about what's out there now, because there's a couple options at this point.
Sure. I think so most Python developers are going to be most familiar with PIP, right? That's the standard. And PIP has requirements files, and you know, they're unique in the lock file world because they can be named anything, right? Most other lock files have a defined name. We were talking about Rust earlier. You know, they're the gold standard for a lot of this stuff. And, you know, they're very clear. They have cargo.lock. That's their lock file. You can't name it anything else. Its contents are well-defined. It is what it is. But in Python with pip, I mean, you could name it whatever you want. You know, dev requirements.txt. Yeah. You could name it cargo.lock, but it could contain Python dependencies in it.
Surprise. You know? I'm
yeah,
not Rust.
Yeah.
And basically, you can just put more or less arbitrary commands that are sent to pip into
yes,
any text
yes,
file, right?
Exactly.
Which is more or less what it is, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Any command line option you can feed the pip, you can put in a requirements file.
It's cool because you can have you import by saying -r some other file.
Yes. Yes.
But
yes,
it's also not
the hierarchy
structured.
That way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So. There are some tools available to turn those like loose requirements files, the pip requirements files, into strict mm-hmm. lock files, right? Where every entry is pinned to a specific version. And pip itself can do it with the pip freeze command. So that's the one most people know about. But that one's kind of not so great because it only freezes the packages for the environment that you ran pip freeze in, you know, and maybe you're trying to publish your lock file for users of a different platform or system.
The other thing that I don't like about it is you want to put just the things you actually use into your requirements file. Like I'm using HTTPX and Pydantic. That's it. But what it really installs when you run that is the transitive closure of all those things, which is fine. But you're not necessarily expressing that with just your requirements.txt, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Your two packages could balloon to, you know, 100 dependencies. And that's not uncommon. It's not even that bad. Like in the JavaScript ecosystem, you know, the same handful of top level dependencies could have a two orders of magnitude explosion where you end up with
I can't find out. You know what? I think it's on, I think I put it on the Python Bytes, but there's a really funny, I want to be able to pull this up for people so they can find it. There's a funny, funny thing that somebody did. Well, you know, for some definition of funny, they put somebody created an NPM package called Everything. And
yes,
so there's an article called "When Everything Becomes Too Much: The NPM Package Chaos of 2024."
Yeah,
an NPM user named Patrick JS launched a troll campaign with a package called Everything, which depends on every package in NPM.
Yeah, yeah, and that's I think it's the NPM's the largest package registry out there. So it's, I mean, it's already massive. I remember your early episodes; you would recount how many packages were on PyPI, and then we got
to that. I
don't
even know. Are we past half a million?
Number. Well, yeah, I remember it was a big deal. We got up to 100,000, and now it's probably what 400,000, 500,000,
508,509 by rounding. Yeah. Half a million. Congratulations, world! Amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
I just added two new ones last week, so I guess I made a huge difference in that number.
Nice.
Yeah, so basically, the pip is awesome, and it does a bunch of great stuff. And one of the things I really like about working with pip is I don't need to teach people anything if they want to work with my project.
Right.
I don't need to teach them like, oh, I know you love poetry, but I'm using a combination of the Hatch build backend with PDM. You're like, what? I don't even know what those are, right? Like, there's a lot of like ways in which you work that are brought in with a lot of these tools here. So pip is kind of like, you know, it just kind of works, right?
Yes.
But having this transitive closure managed is not part of what it does, but it's super important because if I need to upgrade something, I can't just change my version number in my requirements because that doesn't affect its dependency possibly, right? Like it depends on what it's said. So I'm a huge fan of pip tools. This is actually what I do most of the time.
Yes. Pip tools is another one. You can, it's great. I think it has this pip compile command that will take as an input, I think just about any Python manifest type that's out there. So you can do setup.py, requirements.txt. I'm forgetting the other ones.
The pip env.lock maybe, I don't know.
Setup.cfg. PyProject.toml, it just recognizes all the different ways people could express their loose requirements, you know, the manifest files.
I really like it. And you can say pip compile upgrade, and it'll look at all the dependencies and upgrade them all as high as they can go. But what's nice about that is you'll be working for a while, then you choose like, well, let me just do a refresh on the dependencies right now and repin them and see how that works, and then just carry on with your business for a while, right? And it'll manage that transitive closure as well with like actually a really nice lock file that where it described like these are all the things in the lock file. And the reason that, you know, for example, in your blog post, you say they're certified of this version and it's there because you asked for it and because request needs it. You know, if you're like, why is this in my virtual environment? Why do I have this weird thing that I don't know? Like it'll tell you, here's why it's there.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the downsides though, I think pip tools has this issue. I know pip does, is that in determining that transitive dependency resolution, it is very possible. In fact, usually happens that you have arbitrary code execution on your system, right? Like if you start with the two top level dependencies, like you mentioned, and it lists dependencies. Well, then it'll pull those in, and it acquires the metadata from the wheel if that exists. But if it doesn't, it'll build the package just to get the metadata file, just to figure out which dependencies that needs.
And are you saying I should set up a Docker container to execute this?
That's kind of what's happening.
Maybe I should.
And running in a sandbox is another option, right? Where that's what my company, Phylum, that's one of the solutions we offer. We have extensions for our CLI where you can wrap pip by just calling Phylum pip, and then everything runs in the sandbox. So that's another solution. Okay. Yeah. So good, because pip is a funny one because they even have a command line option called dry run, tac dry run, which you would think, oh, nothing's gonna happen on my system. It's just
running code from strangers on the internet.
But it does, yes. Dry run, even using dry run for pip install and pip download commands has the possibility of downloading and running arbitrary code from strangers on the internet. Well,
if we had wheels came along far after pip, right? And we've got the source distributions and setup.py and all that kind of stuff. And so if wheels existed from day one, it very well may be the case that this is not a problem, right? But what is pip supposed to do? Like, it has to evaluate this dynamic thing to figure out what it wants.
Yes. Wheels are great because, they have a metadata file in there that clearly lays out what the dependencies are, and there's no arbitrary code running when you install a wheel. It's just extracting and copying. A wheel is just a zip file. You extract that zip file and then copy the contents to various locations. But yes, as you said, because we've had source distributions, tarballs, and then even eggs before that, and I'm probably never going to fully get rid of those. It just takes one dependency anywhere in your chain that is only distributed as a source distribution before now you're downloading and building a package just to get metadata to continue.
Yeah, and maybe you didn't actually choose it, right? It's the dependency of a dependency of a dependency.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. People often respond to some of the findings our company has, where we'll post these malicious packages with all sorts of crazy names, and people will respond to say, like, why would I install that? Like, why would I ever install this random package that no one's heard of? It's like, well, you wouldn't. It could be included in, the transitive dependencies, right? If it gets added to a slightly more legitimate package, or worked up the chain that way, then eventually you'll be running it unknowingly.
Yeah, I think there's two important things we should talk about this before we move on, because there are some interesting ways in which you might unknowingly, you might even try to do the right thing, and you might actually shoot yourself in the foot by doing so. Number one, these super strict lock files are awesome when you're building an application. I want to ship TalkPython training out. It's got its strict APIs. It runs on this version. It uses that version of Pydantic, that version of Beanie, and whatever.
Yeah.
I want that to be fixed, zero flexibility until I decide, through maybe a pip compile upgrade or whatever, that I want a new one. However, if I was building a library that someone else was using, I would do them many headaches and a disservice to say, I depend on Pydantic 2.7.0. You're like, but my other library needs Pydantic 2.8,
right.
And I can't use it and your library together, right? So you need it's a different story when you're building a library that others are going to consume than it is when you're building an application. And there was some disagreement, I guess, about the recommendation of pip ENV for a while. And it's because I believe the pip ENV is really focused on the application side. And I don't think it was made super clear that maybe it doesn't make as much sense for libraries, right? So you want to speak to that a little?
Yeah. I'm an advocate for lock files for everyone, right? Applications for sure, but also libraries and their developers, right? Because when you distribute a library, sure, loose dependencies is probably the way to go there. But library developers, people who want to contribute to your projects, the developers themselves, maybe you work on a team, having a lock file alongside your library is still going to be useful, right? Like,
yeah, because that way you can say everyone, if somebody makes a change or they report a bug or whatever, they're not bringing in a change from a different version of a dependency or like maybe something changed, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Plus it still allows you to start from a known good spot. And then maybe if you if you know you want to get the latest, then you can do it in a controlled environment, you know, like a sandbox, or maybe on CI in a throwaway runner that has no access to any secrets or sensitive.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about having a specific requirements lock file type of thing for the libraries that I've been working on, for the developers, right? For people who want to contribute, because it's just been like a loose requirement so that people that build against it aren't pinned into some very specific thing. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense, I think.
Yeah. There's a link in that blog post. It's kind of dated now, but it's from the folks who built Yarn, you know, the JavaScript ecosystem. Yeah. But they say it a lot more eloquently than I can. Yeah, that's the one.
Lock files should be committed
on all projects. Yeah, it's a bit old now, but they go down the lists and spell it out a lot more clearly than me about why libraries even can benefit from publishing a lock
people
file.
People can check that out. That's cool.
Yeah,
in Java, that's the JavaScript package manager. So in JavaScript, it's like 100 years or something. It's been a couple of years.
That's right. Yeah.
You got dog years, you got JavaScript years. JavaScript years just tick by like second hand.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Cool. So I see we're making great progress through our list of things to talk about here. Mm-hmm. I've gone through three and we've got like 15 left. We'll have plenty of time. let's see. So another PEP I think we're talking about here is 517, a build system independent format for source trees. I have no idea what this is. What is this?
Yeah, PEP 517 and 518 kind of go together. This was like the transition away from setup.py towards pyproject.toml. 518 is the one that specifies pyproject.toml, kind of things that go in it. And then 517 is all about build systems and build backends. So like in your pyproject.toml and in your build system key, you know, you often see things like Poetry Core or Flit or Hatchling or these kinds of things. And so it's PEP 517 is specifying what it means to be one of those build backends. It's really just defining two mandatory hooks. What does it mean to build wheel and build sdist? There's three optional hooks as well. And I think there's even another PEP that followed on from this that talks about building editable packages
dash E equivalents.
Yeah, exactly. But really it just boils down to defining a way to build a wheel and build a source distribution.
Yeah. And this is part of what opened up all the different choices we now have for package management and things like that, right? Because now there's a common way they can all work together, a little bit like WSGI.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so, I've been using Hatchling for my build backend recently, and it's been working real nicely.
Okay. Yeah, I was just looking at Hatchling the other day, and they've got they're one of the build backends that offers build hooks, which, you know, so prior to pyproject.toml and wheels and BDS wheels, and you go back to the source distributions, you know, and your setup.py files where it's just Python code. You could be doing anything in your setup.py file, which runs when you install the package. Well, now we're starting to see, you know, methods to do the same thing in these more modern packaging or build backends. So like Hatch has their build system hooks where you can point it to, I think, just Python code and have it run as part of the build.
Yeah, at least it only runs at build time, not install time. Right?
Yeah, I'm looking at the documentation now. Yeah, this is still new to me, but there might be hooks for install as well.
Okay. While you're thinking about it, one of the things, I got a couple of questions I want to highlight from the audience here, but also one of the things that I think
maybe was considered. I have no awareness of this, but if it wasn't, it would be excellent. Is what if the people at PIP just pre-computed all that metadata from, at least for the common platforms, that you would get that PIP needs to download, run setup pi, and then throw it away just to get that data? Like for Mac, Windows, and Linux, you know, if it would just go, okay, we're just going to, like, as you upload it, just kick off a job that does that on those three platforms and puts it in a JSON blob.
Yeah.
It seems like that would be worthwhile.
I'm fairly certain there's discussions already around that type of a solution, and maybe even a PEP or proposal for it. But yeah, getting away from having to build a package just to get metadata.
You got
discussion for
packages
it.
That are downloaded billions of times with a B. It's insane.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody could do that three times instead of a billion times, it would make it work faster, and it would also make it safe, right? I think it'd be great.
Yeah.
All right, a couple of questions here. This one. So Tony out in the audience says, pip compile is great for finding your transitive dependencies. One interesting thing that they've done is package up code with pants build, which supports locks files, just to look through what code gets packaged up. Is this anything you've explored?
I've heard of pants. I haven't looked into it myself yet.
Mm-hmm. So just use it like, go, okay, you're going to have to build this thing and give me a little manifest and whatnot. And then we can just look at that. That's cool.
Yeah.
And then Tamir says, do you have a solution for taking already locked dependencies with you when you start a new app? I'm guessing, I don't know. I guess maybe you've already got a project you're working on. You want to say like, I want this project, use that. And probably you could just copy the lock file, right?
Yeah. Yeah. If you start a new project or new application, you're gonna have new manifest file. You know, pyproject.toml. Maybe you have the same dependencies, the top level dependencies or not, but the fully resolved set of dependencies that makes up your lock file that could very easily be different. So I'm not exactly sure how you just port over one to another.
One more bit from Tony. This is something that I now remember from Pants is. If it just looks through your code, and if you use the import statement, regardless of whether you've put it in your requirements files, it'll figure out what your requirements files should have been if you were a bad developer, basically. That's kind of cool just to see what it uses. Yeah. Nice. All right. On to the next thing. Specifying PEP 518, specifying minimum build system requirements for Python projects.
This is pyproject.toml. This is the PEP for that. There's not much to it other than to say that they settled on that name, rejected a bunch of other possibilities, and then they've got the few entries that are required, like for your finding your build
system.
Yeah,
you don't have to have a pyproject.toml for Python, but
no.
If you're building a Python library and you don't want to use setup.py, then you're much better off having a pyproject.toml, right?
Yes. Yeah.
It's more on the library side it's not that you can't use it on an application, but it's more required on the library side. That's the thing. All right, so let's talk about some of the ways in which your packages might go wrong. We've already talked about typo squatting, and we also talked about everything that's different. Your typo squatting is tricky. I think it's pretty well understood at this point, but maybe just tell people real quick to cover that base, you know?
Sure. Typo squatting is you know, publishing a package with a name that's similar but not the same as a existing known good package, right? So like instead of requests, maybe you get request without the S One that gets me because I make the typo all the time is the cryptography package. If I put you on the spot, would you know how to spell cryptography? Right away? I always get the first couple letters, jumbled up a bit, and there have been malicious packages published and then taken down, with spelled CRPY instead of CRYP cryptography. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
But the idea is that, you can overlook a package because it looks like a good one. It's not necessarily that you're gonna install it because you type it wrong, although that is one technique, right? The drive-by installs where someone just fat fingers the package name. But really, having a typo squatted package is going to allow these threat actors to be a little more stealthy in their inclusion of that package in legitimate code reviews and commits and dependencies of dependencies, right? And so the other thing that goes with typo squatting, I don't know if I had a link for you there yet, is star jacking. So a lot of times if you're going to typo squat on a known good package, okay, there it is. You know, these threat actors, they just straight up copy the known good project, right? It just clone the repository and then change the package name. And then when they post the package to PyPI, for instance, the metadata that goes with the package still exists, right? So on PyPI for a given package, you can see on the left-hand side, it shows like some statistics. If the URL was given to like a GitHub hosted project, for instance, it'll go in there and tell you how many stars
that package has.
You know, how many downloads.
That's actually a signal that it seems like it should be good, right? It'll have
And that's what star jacking is doing, is just copying the metadata of a known good package so that on first look, you can see.
I did pull up PyTest and it says statistics, GitHub statistics, 11,000 stars, 2,000 forks. Okay, this is legit. Let's install it.
Right. So I could go clone PyTest repository right now, change the name to PyTest spelled P-I-T-E-S-T, and then push
the
that
math
to
version
PPI,
of testing. Yeah.
And you're going to get these same statistics and you're going to get the same maintainers that you see if you scroll down a little bit in the meta. Data, yeah. So you get the maintainers list, all of that metadata that you enter in your pyproject.toml or setup.py file gets read here on PyPI and just published. So you can fake people out
That's actually really, you know, okay. Well, there's a new terrifying thing that I hadn't thought about.
Yeah, yeah. So star jacking and typo squatting, where you just take a known good package, clone it, and then maybe you make a change to you know, existing function. You know, the function does what it's supposed to do, but it also does some other stuff like ship off secrets from your CI server or, you know,
it could lay dormant and wait for some sort of production environment and grab some SSH keys or something terrible.
Yeah. 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 That's the other, indeed. the other thing. Yeah. Dependency confusion. Okay. That's the next one you've got up.
Yeah. This is the one we kind of talked. It's similar to what we talked about before with, I can't remember, but I said there's going to come back to this. So here it is again. This is dependency confusion where if you get the wrong version or the wrong name, it could actually, you try to be safe by having a whitelisted list or.
So this is one where it's the same package name, different source of where you acquire that package.
Yes.
So this is, these attacks are mostly like companies, enterprises.
This is the enterprise attack. Yeah.
So
we use an Artifactory, and we only put our stuff there, and we're gonna call it like, you know, international company underscore data access.
That's right, and it's tricky because if you don't know, like if you don't have your build system set up in a way, and then your CI server set up in a way to install your dependencies in the proper order, like excluding public registries first and only looking for packages in your private registry, then it's very easy, especially with pip, which defaults to looking on PyPI, the public registry, first, and then only falling back to your extra index URL specifications secondly. That if someone had the knowledge or just guessed at the package name that you had published on your internal registry, and then they made their own package with the same name but put it on PyPI, that's the one that's going to get installed. And there was like a whole series of, you know, bug bounties that were claimed over this back a few years ago because people just went around, you know, guessing at internal package names, or maybe they used to work there or knew people.
I'll pay $100 just to share your quorum.txt with me.
Right.
You know, it's extra sneaky because it only affects people who are going out of their way to be more secure, right? They're going out of their way to say, we're going to actually set up a whole server and we're going to whitelist a bunch of stuff. You can only ask for the names of the things on this server. And
Yes. And that might still work if you limit it to your internal registry only, or a mirror perhaps of the public registries.
What do you think about that? It's pretty easy to create your own internal copy, download a bunch of external ones and mirror them locally and say, like, these are the ones that are pre-approved at our company, nothing else.
Yeah. I worked in an environment where that's exactly what we did. And I think there is merit to that. You just have to know that anything you're mirroring to the trusted internal network is in fact secure.
Yeah, for sure. I think, it doesn't really make sense, except for a few very rare cases, to say you cannot use external dependencies.
Right.
Yeah, you're just saying what we want is to not build software, but while the rest of the world does.
Yes.
Because that's part of the magic. We just saw that it's over 500,000 libraries you can choose from. Mm-hmm. When you say we have zero of those, you're really, really constraining the type of software and the velocity at which you can build.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It reminds me of there's that line, like, why do you rob banks?
Because they have the money.
Because that's where the money is, right? It's like, well, why are attackers going after open source software now? Like, well, that's where it's easiest to get arbitrary code to run.
Yeah.
That's where developers are.
To be fair, though, it's not only, right? There's SolarWinds, which really had almost nothing to do with open source, but it had to do with CI/CD systems and other sneakiness, right?
Yeah.
And got into places that, instead of getting into the libraries, you get into the build system and you just give it a little extra include tag there in your code, or bring in that DLL, like you said, right? So dependency confusion is sneaky because you're asking for a local version off a local server. It doesn't exist on PyPI, but if it could be made to exist on PyPI, all of a sudden that gets installed. That's not good.
Potentially, yeah. That's how it works in all the default cases, and it's pretty tricky actually to exclude to do it in the correct order and exclude those public registries.
Yeah. What I do to help this is I just run the UUID command to get one of those 16-digit arbitrary hex things, and I just name all my libraries that. And so it's like, oh, do you have the F3DC?
Yes.
Oh, that's the API one. That's right. That's import that, right? No one is going to do this. It's such a safe space, I tell you. All right, on to the next one.
That would work.
Expired author domains. This is super sneaky.
Yeah. So this is one. It might be less of a factor now. I think it was just earlier this month that PyPI enforced two-factor authentication for all their users. But a lot of sites and even PyPI, I think before this month, have password reset features where if you lose access to your account or you forget your password, just send me an email, reset your password. But it's very possible that people years ago submitted a package, they don't maintain it anymore. They submitted it under an old email account that has expired. Right? Maybe they
had some domain.
Yeah.
This doesn't work that well for Gmail or Outlook.
If
you had a custom domain and as would be awesome, have your own, michael@talkpython.fm, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Say you win the lottery decide to quit your day job. Yeah. And then you let your domain expire. And well, maybe there's still a linkage for the TalkPython domain to PyPI. And then I go and buy that domain and, request
set
password
up some server,
account reset,
set up email.
And then now I can publish new versions of the packages there.
Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what to do about that one. But there's an amazing amazing joke that I found on Mastodon. Somebody posted here. It's two big red buttons. Think Ren and Stimpy or whatever. And one of the red buttons says, "Admit to yourself that your dream is dead." The other one says, "Pay $12 right, for domain renewal." Right?
Yes.
And I mean, it's funny, but there's plenty of people who will get a domain and I totally go in, and then it's like, you know what? I haven't done anything with that for like 5 years. I'm not paying another $12. But if they had set up an account under that, right? Mm-hmm. This is what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why you got to buy your domains for that 100-year renewal period.
Exactly. you take out that loan, you get your domain. All right. We're getting short on time here. I want let's just go through. I'll just list off a few real quick. Maybe we do lightning round. Okay.
Okay.
Unverifiable dependency.
Okay. These are for specifying dependencies that are not necessarily published to PyPI, right? So that maybe you're pointing to a GitHub repository. You know, pip calls these VCS project URLs, you know, if you look in their help output.
Yeah, it's like pip install git plus HTTP to a thing that has a exactly. project or Tom or set. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that thing, it can point to a repository, maybe it points to a tag, maybe it points to a branch. None of that is stable, right? Like the tag could change out from under you. The code that's related to that tag could change out from under you. The code at the branch you're pointing to could change, while the name remains the same. So you know those are risky for that reason, right? If you're not pinning to a very specific version or a very specific hash, right? If you're going to point to a repository or a Git URL.
Interesting.
Sure it's
true. I kind of feel a lot of times like the hash is maybe a little bit redundant given the immutability of PyPI, but if you're pointing at something like this, then maybe all of a sudden you really do want that.
Yes.
For sure. Yeah. Okay. Repo jacking.
Yeah, this is similar to the expired author domain, right? So if someone was, you know, pointing to one of those Git dependencies, a VCS project URL, as pip calls it, and you know, that account went dormant or expired, relinquished, whatever, and someone else took it over, they can now dictate
what's there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. What people are requiring. Yeah.
All right. And then maybe last bit, get a chance to talk a bit about your Phylum CI project. I do want to point out really quick though that Phylum was a sponsor of the show.
Yes.
A while ago, but this is not a sponsored episode. This is just you and I had been talking prior to that, actually, and decided to like put this show together. So just to be clear, but let's talk about this this project you guys got anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can pip install Phylum right now, or like I prefer pipx install Phylum.
Yeah. And I love pipx. It's awesome.
Yeah. Me too. Yeah. I think I heard about it from you, actually. But,
so the circle goes.
Yes. 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 So this package, it does two main things. It exposes two entry points. One of them is called phylum init, and that'll get you the phylum command line interface written in Rust, but installed with Python. it'll get you the phylum CLI locally. And then the other one is called Phylum CI. That's just a catch-all entry point, the thing that gets exposed through our Docker container to handle almost all of our integrations. You know, so if you want to monitor your PRs on GitHub, for instance, you know, we've got an integration for that.
Nice. So the idea is basically that I could set this up in GitHub. A PR comes in, I could set up an action. Phylum will scan it for known mischievousness.
That's right.
And make that part of the PR, maybe even block it out, right?
Yeah, exactly. It'll fail your build if you don't pass your, you know, default policy or established policy on any of your given log files or manifests. We deal with manifests as well. And you mentioned GitHub. So even with GitHub, we went a step further. We have an app as well. So you don't even have to modify a workflow. You could just install a GitHub app and automatically monitor your repositories. But a lot of the other ecosystems, you know, don't have that. So we just provide Docker containers. Yeah,
I love the Docker container. So you use Docker run against your code or whatever.
So there's even a pre-commit hook we expose as well. Nice. So you can.
Nice. I genuinely don't know the answer to this question. Does this cost money?
No. We have, you can sign anyone. Anyone can sign up for free. There's a community edition where you can have up to 5 projects.
Okay, cool. That are monitored. You guys have to eat. There must be some way you charge for some.
Oh, exactly. Things. Yeah, yeah. There's the paid version, right? Which unlimited projects. You get access to group-based management. There's a few extra features. It's a freemium model.
More of a Teams enterprisey angle.
Yeah. But for this audience, I mean, I would love if everyone just went that little extra step of securing their open source software and go with the free option. I'm not trying to sell you anything here. Just monitor your awesome. Your manifest, your lock files. Make sure that you remain secure. You're not exposing your secrets, because that's what we're finding now, is that developers are the new high value targets.
Yeah.
That's what attackers want to go after, because we know that developers, they have the secrets. They've got the keys.
We write the code that then gets run on the production server inside the firewalls.
Yeah. We have all the access, all the access, all the secrets, all the keys. So if you can find a way to get arbitrary code from strangers to run on developer systems, you're gonna have a much better.
We're having a good time. Yeah. We have a good time. Having a bad time.
Right.
Yeah. Doing bad things. Okay. Yeah. Let's not do that. Awesome. Well, excellent work. I think probably we'll kind of just leave it there. We're pretty much out of time for the rest of the stuff, but close it out for us, Charlie. People are maybe both have a few new tools to work with, but also techniques, but maybe also a little freaked out. What do you tell them?
I would recommend everyone to restrict their use of dependencies to lock files, and then carefully gate or guard the inclusion of new lock files or updates of existing ones, or sorry, dependencies in those lock files with careful analysis. Don't allow arbitrary code to run anywhere in your development process, and give Phylum a try. We've got the free community edition. We will provide that analysis and ensure that you don't have malware running on your system through bad dependencies.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. All right. Well, it's been very interesting and a lot of new things to think about. So thanks for being here.
Thank you, Michael.
Yep. See you later.
This has been another episode of Talk Python to Me. Thank you to our sponsors. Be sure to check out what they're offering. It really helps support the show. Take some stress out of your life. Get notified immediately about errors and performance issues in your web or mobile applications with Sentry. Just visit talkpython.fm/Sentry and get started for free. And be sure to use the promo code TALKPYTHON, all one word.
Mailtrap, an email delivery platform that developers love. Use their email sandbox to inspect and debug emails in staging, dev, and QA environments before sending them to recipients in production. Try Mailtrap for free at talkpython.fm/mailtrap.
Want to level up your Python? We have one of the largest catalogs of Python video courses over at TalkPython. Our content ranges from true beginners to deeply advanced topics like memory and async. And best of all, there's not a subscription in sight. Check it out for yourself at training.talkpython.fm. Be sure to subscribe to the show, open your favorite podcast app, and search for Python. We should be right at the top. You can also find the iTunes feed at /iTunes, the Google Play feed at /play, and the direct RSS feed at /RSS on talkpython.fm. We're live streaming most of our recordings these days. If you want to be part of the show and have your comments featured on the air, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at talkpython.fm/YouTube. This is your host, Michael Kennedy. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Now get out there and write some Python code.